You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and my guest today is the brilliant comic and actress and performer of herself, Lucy Beaumont, who is most known for her role on Meet the Richardsons, in which she co-stars with her real-life husband, John Richardson. And she's known as the writer and creator of To Hull and Back and the co-writer on Channel 4's Hullraisers. She is about to embark on her 2023 stand-up tour. You can get tickets at lucybeaumont.co.uk, and you can follow her socials at Lucy A. Beaumont on Twitter and The One From Hull, underscores in between all those words, on Instagram. This is a really fascinating chat. We're going to talk about, I mean, one of the huge things that came out of this for me is when she's talking about writing processes for other characters, she talks about letting in spirits. And I was fascinated as to whether she was pulling my leg or whether she was speaking metaphorically. And the exploration of the answers to those questions is absolutely fascinating. So lots of great stuff to come. We've got 15 minutes of extra content available exclusively to the Insiders Club, including Lucy's experience with ADHD and the impact it's had on her career, a really interesting insight into how to think about jokes, and some more info on how she's preparing for her tour. All of that can be found at comedianscomedian.com/insiders by supporting the show with a minimum donation of £2 a month, for which you get ad-free episodes and all the other extra content. Now, let's get into this conversation with the brilliant and very funny Lucy Beaumont. Thanks for joining me, Lucy. Lovely to welcome you to the show. This is us starting, by the way. I've launched from chat into officially starting. How are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, very well, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm really well. Are you at home? I'm in my cellar.
Are you really in your cellar?
Yeah. It's a bit lacking in actual daylight. I've got to do something clever with a door with glass in it or something, because it's a bit depressing.
That's what a cellar is, isn't it?
Yeah.
It'd be an underground conservatory if it was light, wouldn't it?
That's true. And I've never heard the term underground conservatory before, and that seems particularly you. How is comedy treating you at the moment?
Oh, it's treating me well at the moment. Yeah, yeah. I could do a full shop at Marks and Spencer's if I wanted to.
I think you've interpreted that question as being, how are you doing financially out of
it? Oh, right. Well, that's what it is, isn't it? Yeah. I'm only in it for the money.
You're in quite a strange position, I think, at the moment. You're quite an unusual position in that you're preparing to go on tour in the autumn, and it's a stand-up show.
Yes, yeah.
And you are, I know you as a stand-up, I think we met each other years ago in sort of like late 2017, 18, 19, something like that. But you haven't been, you're not known for stand-up since then. Have you been, like, you're known for being funny in a wide variety of other formats, writing and your book, which I've read some of, is really, really funny, and obviously Meet the Richardsons, all of this stuff. So most people who are in your position kind of fame-wise, your profile and able to tour at that kind of level, would have, like, maybe a more regular kind of stand-up basis behind them. So I'm interested in how you're approaching that, how you feel about that.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, that it's nice to go. It's nice to be back doing it. Like you say, I wasn't. And really, over the last few years, the only gigs I've done are charity gigs. But I am. That's what I started out as, you know, as a stand up. And there were, I think there was lots of reasons why I haven't done that as regularly. I mean, the main one is being a mum, you know, and really letting, sorry, Stu, my phone's going by me. I don't actually need this phone on, do I?
No, you don't. You don't.
I'll record it. I'm going to turn it off because it's, sorry. Shall I go back?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah. Come in again or whatever. I mean, you were saying stand-up is how you started.
Yeah, yes. So stand-up is how I started out, and it's nice to be back feeling like a comic. And there's lots of reasons why I've took such a big hiatus, really. Mainly that I had a daughter, you know, and I sort of consciously stopped doing stand-up when we knew we were trying for a baby, and I started to try to get good at writing so that I could be at home really more. And I had a love-hate relationship with stand-up. I came into stand-up at a time when the sexism and misogyny was unbearable. It was preventing me doing my job properly. And some of that was like culturally at the time, but a lot of that was it got into my head. I just believed everyone I'd ever heard tell me that women aren't funny, and I could sabotage gigs, and I became so nervous. And now it's a totally different landscape. I don't, of course, you got a few, you know, men who like to catch carp on a weekend telling younger women that they aren't funny. They all like to catch carp. There's something about men who catch carp don't find younger women funny. But mostly it's fair game. And maybe not. I mean, I'm speaking on behalf of I'm not speaking on behalf of young female comics because I don't really know their experience. But it seems to me like it's a bit easier, and of course I've done a bit of telly, so again people are coming to watch me because of me, whereas I started out comedy where, you know, I'd walk onto stage and even before I opened my mouth half the audience would get up to get a drink or go to the toilet or put their head down, and they just thought before they'd even let me begin that I was going to be bad. You know, so that's the difference. But it got to me really where I just lost my bottle for it, really.
Was there a particular kind of trigger point? Was there a particular gig or experience where you thought, sod this, I'm not doing it anymore? Or was it sort of a long, slow accumulation of negative experiences?
It was a Leicester Mercury competition, which, as you know, is quite a prestigious one, isn't it, really, with comics. And Ramesh won, very deserved, you know, he should have, like, you know, he was amazing, and he'd waited his time. I mean, as you know, Ramesh had been gigging a while, you know, and he was so ready to start, you know, obviously went stratospheric. But yeah, that competition, it was me and it was every other act was a man. And what it was, it wasn't Ramesh winning. It was the review. I won't say the reviewer. Again, a viewer, everyone who knows comedy knows really well. And he reviewed the gig and I was in tears because I'd had a blinder. I'd had an absolute blinder. It was one of the best gigs I'd done. And he described all the lads, he described the type of acts they had and the type of comedy. And with me, he only described what I looked like. Could have been describing anyone, just someone off the street. By reading it, you wouldn't have even known I was doing a stand-up. And it was that I was like elfin, but fairly pretty and probably going to go on to do TV because she's fairly good looking. And I was more upset about that than like the heckles of people shouting, you know, get your tits out, or, you know, or like promoters that whisper in your ear, look, if it goes badly, just do 5 minutes and get off, but don't say that to the men. I don't know, there was something about that. And I think because I had done, I'd done such a good gig. And then it was followed up by, I went to do a gig somewhere, and a local radio, it was BBC as well. A BBC local radio interviewed me before I did it. And the first question they asked was, do you think women are funny as men? And it had been like a topic on like actual BBC that, yeah, that day that they'd ran with. Because this is back like 2011. So it was like just a lot of those things all grouped together. But for some reason that Lester Mercury, and I emailed him and was, you know, really angry, and he deleted it offline. You can't find it. Mm. So he obviously knew it was wrong, but wouldn't apologize, you know, wouldn't. I said, I want you to apologize. It's not fair, you know. But yeah, so it was, for me, it was, I just was like, maybe I'm not as funny as men. Maybe I'm just never going to be as funny as any male stand-up. So why don't I just stop and have a baby and stay at home and write?
And the thing, one of the things that's so kind of tragic about that is that we're only hearing that story from you because you've been able to find another route to keep going. Like you didn't, you stopped, but you paused, and now you're going to come back and the landscape is very differently. I wonder how many people have been in that position and stopped and just gone on and done something else. And they didn't stay within the comedy world. They didn't stay kind of writing. And then they weren't afforded the opportunity to come back and actually reflect on that from the perspective of a much more different power and a much more different profile. So it's like, you know what I mean? Like I'm hearing that, and I'm just, because it is, I hope it's such a different landscape now, that feels like a story that I'm like, it's awful to hear. But there is a note of hope now in that, oh, I feel like it's really different now, in as much as I get to absorb any of that. Like you said, there's so many more female comics breaking boundaries that have been for years. But what strikes me is like, oh, Jesus, that's like, I haven't heard that story for a while. And how many people will we never hear that story from? Because it was so shit at the time that they quit.
Yeah, and it's... It's to do with the landscape. Like, I think as well, also because we have needed more female comics, I think it happened with me where you sort of get plucked a bit too early as well. So you're not learning your craft. And I do see it a lot with female. I think, I know you want to be, you know, you want to take some couple aside and say, I know you want to be on telly, but you're not ready. You know, take it from me. I started doing telly before I was ready. I'm only ready now, like literally this last year, if I'm totally honest. And if I'd have come along now, but, you know, that can put you off, that you start telly too early. Mm-hmm. And this is what, you know, I'm going, doing a tour. I'm sort of learning the craft now because you sort of do get very busy with other things and you stop focusing. And you know, I see a lot of my peers and I think, how the hell have you had time to write a show? Because you're on telly every week.
Yeah.
Like you haven't lived, you've got to have lived a bit, you know. So I think the major sort of agencies and managers, I think, can sometimes work comics too much. I think a good manager should say, don't do this, go and live a bit, because you're a stand-up and
you know. But then we all know there are kind of management styles which are hoover everyone up, chuck them out there, see what sticks, and then go with them. Do you know what I mean? Rather than that kind of, like as you're describing, that sort of nourishing, nurturing kind of approach.
And I think there's something, if you've waited 10 years to start earning good money, you just want to say yes to everything. Mm. You know, but yeah, so I think it's a mixture of the two. It was definite terrible prejudice and sexism, and also, you know, sort of exposing people before they're ready. I think that it's those two things, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you say you just feel ready now, what are the elements that go into that? Like, what is it that you have now that you didn't have before? I imagine there's lots of things, but can we just talk about some of those?
Yeah, like, do you know, everything I say in my head, there's another voice saying, you're not funny. But you're still thinking, well, I was going to say, well, I'm no more funnier than I was before. I just feel like I just relaxed a bit, to be honest, and just feel I can be myself a bit more on things. I think that's what it is. And not just being so terrified and just being completely, sometimes just feeling completely out. I felt completely out of my depth, I think, you know. And that maybe, you know, I don't have that sort of, you know, I think it's amazing how some performers just have this sort of natural confidence, you know, and you think, you've only been going 2 years. How are you this confident at Live at the Apollo? Like,
yeah.
But that's not me, you know. I still get, you know, terribly nervous and still question if I'm good enough to take people's time up, you know, because that's really what you're doing. That's time that those people are never going to get back. It feels like a massive weight on your shoulders.
Yeah. But then there is something whereby, like, you are really loved as a comic and as a comic voice. Like, you know, there's, you know, YouTube collections of Lucy Beaumont's funniest moments and stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like, people really value your comic voice. And the genuineness, the authenticity of that voice. And I think part of that is that you are unafraid to point out that you're afraid.
Yeah, maybe. I try not to. It's such a weird... I mean, I think the only thing I can sort of positively say about myself is I do feel I am very down to earth. It's just, I don't try to be. I just don't know how to be anything else. But because of that, this whole world still is very odd to me. I can't sort of think about it too much because it's just mad, you know, like, to be on telly and people know you are, and it's, yeah, yeah, it's, I can't think about it too much. So I can't sort of reference, I don't know what my profile is like, and I don't watch anything I've done, and I don't like to look at anything on YouTube, and so yeah, it's a very odd one. I'm still getting my head around it, really.
So this is Lucy. I mean, listen, there are many, many reasons to have Lucy on your podcast. She's brilliant, she's funny, she's candid, she's wonderful, but also it's just a joy to listen to her voice. And I really do apologise to everyone in Hull for whom it's a completely normal accent. And I'm sorry for my southern-centric... I don't want... You know what I mean? You don't want to cutify anyone by going, oh, listen to a lovely voice. But, it's not just the Hull accent. It's such a good voice. Isn't it a great voice? So more from Lucy in just a second. We're going to talk more about her writing style and her processes. Plus, we have these incredible stuff coming up on letting in the voices of spirits in order to help her write characters. And we are also, towards the end of this episode, we are going to discuss some of the prejudice and the misogyny that she's experienced and that she's seen around on the comedy circuit. So some serious and very important stuff to talk about there. All coming up in just a second. 15 minutes of extras on the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, where you can get ad-free episodes and all the extra content from every episode that has it. And do remember, go to lucybeaumont.co.uk in order to... I've got a link here and I don't believe it, so I'm just going to go with the homepage, lucybeaumont.co.uk, where I'm sure you will find a link to find out more about her Trouble and Strife tour, which is happening in the later part of this year. Anyway, let's get back to this conversation with Lucy Beaumont.
We were talking about stand-up and having paused it for a long time, the landscape having changed. You're returning to it now. Are you doing warm-up shows now for the tour? Is the tour show written? How do you work as a stand-up? Where are you with that?
Well, I because maybe where I was from, I didn't go and watch live stand-up. I've had quite a weird way into it. I had a Billy Connolly video and I had an Eddie Izzard video that's all I had, and that's all I'd seen. I'd never been to see live comedy, and I've talked about it so many times with so about this bloody crow landing on my head, but it genuinely was why I thought I'll go and try stand up and do a gig. And so my first gig was So You Think You're Funny, Heat, and my third gig was the final. And so they were my first three gigs. And as I say, I'd only ever watched two videos. I had no idea what I was doing. And then all I watched was Les Dawson YouTube videos. So I've not been able to sort of mimic anyone I think I would have been so much better if I'd have gone to Edinburgh for a few years and saw shows.
I think there is a value, though, to having invented it for yourself. Do you know what I mean? There's certain people you can tell, oh, this comic is really in the mould of that particular comic. You can say, this newer comic is a huge fan of James Acaster or a huge fan of Stuart Lee or a huge fan of Victoria Wood. And you can kind of go, oh, they know, they've got an idea in their head for what they think stand-up is based on a particular person or a particular style. But I think there's a real value as well in when you see someone and you go, oh, this is interesting, because they haven't seen loads. They're not a student of it. They're just inventing what it is for themselves.
Yeah, I think as well, I'd seen Millican, I'd seen Sarah Millican on TV, and that was quite a big moment because she was Northeast and had, you know, I'm sure she would, Mammy said, a funny little voice. And I've got a funny little voice. That really helped as well, because I hadn't seen anyone that I thought, look, you know, that thing of you've got to see it to be it, or, you know, whatever. But yeah, so... In terms of like how I structure things, I've not really moved from the way I've done it. And I like gags. I'm old fashioned. I like 70s and 80s, you know, sitcoms, and I like gags. I tend to want to write almost one liners that, you know, that what I like doing is taking real life events and making little gags out of them. I don't like to do routines. I like to try and keep the laughs, you know, every few seconds. And I'm trying to do bigger routines, and I'm trying to learn the structure more. And I really want this show to be good, you know, want it to be good stand-up, because I can write it, but I never knew how to structure it, really. And so it's nice sort of revisiting, you know, and there's so much, you know, like Netflix is like, can you imagine, like when we started, if we had Netflix, like the amount we can see from, you know, around the world, you know. I mean, I was even watching I went to Tenerife, and I sat for ages watching, because Russian female stand-up comedy in Russia has really taken off. Okay. And I couldn't understand what they were saying, but the patter, I could tell it was funny.
Sure.
You know, I just liked hearing it. I'm a rhythm person. I'm not so bothered about technique and structure. I like the rhythm of a gag, and that's why I like sort of, you know, almost like one-liners, to be honest.
Yeah. Can you just, that's really interesting. And I love the idea of watching comedy in a language you don't speak and recognising the rhythm. And like, I feel like I've done that with some Indian comedy that I've seen online. And I've thought, oh, wow, yeah, these are the rhythms. Not that it's homogenised, but there's a comedy language. Could you, this is a bit putting you on the spot, but could you think of a bit of yours, a stand-up bit of yours that particularly illustrates that leans into that rhythm, like an old bit maybe, or something that you could just talk a little bit more about the rhythm of your comedy and the rhythm of your voice?
I suppose it's like when I think the audience seem to like the gags where I subvert it, where it's got a double punchline, you know. So probably the easiest one is, you know, I was in London, and a man said, where are you from? And I said, Hull on the North East Coast. And he said, say East Coast again. I said, East Coast. And he went, oh, bless you. And he had no legs.
uh, Yes, gotcha. Because so that's definitely an illustration of the rhythmic thing. And also because, like, what is, just to take that joke, like the fact of you telling the story, the element that he had no legs at the end and kind of keeping that, like, could you break down for us what you think is funny about that? Because I think that's funny. Obviously, that's a great joke that works. But, like, what is the like, is it the information being revealed that way round? Or is it simply the rhythm? Or is it the slightly absurd nature of whether or not there's a link between him having no legs and him saying bless you?
It's just because it's a double punchline. So you think, so when I do it, I slow it down a lot. So I just say, and he went, oh, bless you. And then they laugh because they think that's the punchline.
Yeah.
And then you say, and then you pause. And again, I like it when you can experiment with how long to leave a pause, because it can be a millisecond wrong and it don't get a bigger laugh. And he had no legs, and then they're like, oh, and then, you know, they laugh at that because that's the, and then, you know, but that just genuinely happened. I wasn't trying to write, but not it's a clever joke, but, you know, I wasn't trying to write a twist. It came out like that, and then people were like, oh, she's wrote a twist. I was like, oh, yeah, I have. But I genuinely hadn't. I'm not that clever.
So in the writing of the tour show, which is called The Trouble and Strife, which is touring from, is it from October?
Yeah.
In the writing of that show, are you, like that's a way I write, in particular. I wonder if it's about the way the shape, the way my brain works. I often will try and trick myself into talking as naturally and specifically as possible, not worrying about it being funny, and then notice the bits they laugh at and then go, oh, right, those are the jokes, and then go back and try and elevate those.
Right,
something similar, or is it
not so much? No, I do like try to work out what the punchline is. Yeah, but like if it's a double punchline, I wouldn't necessarily maybe know that, and that I've done a double. You know, if you know what I mean. But no, I tend to want to try and write them. Like I know, I think it's amazing people that sort of go on stage with some ideas and then sort of work it out whilst they're on stage. I don't want to do that. That's too scary to me. I've sort of almost scripted it, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I tend to.
Because you're a proper writer, and I'm always, to me, that's scary. It's like, God, you've written a sitcom. I saw the first episode of Hellraisers, you know, and like you've done proper writing. Like you've written a book, you've written like proper things with proper characters. And that completely mystifies me how people can do that, because I feel like I've spent years trying to refine my comic voice and I wouldn't know how to write in someone else's voice. So like what is it about the or what have you learned about the difference between writing for yourself and writing for other characters?
Well, it's listening to dead people.
Go on.
It's going in a trance where you let spirits talk to you and they become the characters. And it doesn't happen. So in Hellraisers, Paula, the rest were just made up of like, how would I picture this person talking? And sometimes it's really hard. Like sometimes in a script, there's characters, they're unwritten, they're underwritten, you know, and sometimes, you know, you don't know it, but production companies get other writers in just that they go unlisted, you know, it's this thing of writers find writing hard as well. Do you know, I think it puts people off doing it, and you think everyone can, you can, there's no secret formula. No one, it's just, it's really, really hard, and you will get there. But with Paula definitely was a dead person coming through to me. I couldn't shut her voice off, and her voice was so clear that I just think it just was someone who was dead, and I was picking up on the energy of them. To Hull and Back was written for me. That was a mother and a daughter came through, and I was just keeping up with them. That was totally dead spirits who wrote that. If I'd have known the name, I would have credited them.
That's incredible. That's an incredible way of looking at it. To what extent are you using, just so I'm clear, to what extent are you using dead people, in inverted commas, as a metaphor for the creativity coming out of somewhere you don't know where it's from? And to what extent do you mean literally dead people?
No, I literally, totally, 100% believe that when you, like most writers, when you get characters that are fully formed and what they call write themselves, you have picked up on spirits.
That's amazing. I've never heard anyone put it like that before.
I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of writers and I've convinced them that that's right.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Let's assume that that is empirically true. People have died, their spirits hang around and they see a writer and they go, great, I'm going to get in there and express myself via that writer. Purely as a sort of, from a writing perspective, which doesn't take a position on whether or not it's dead people. What are the pros and cons of that? I would imagine, my assumption would be that, well, you need to, do you then have part of your process where you're like, right, I've got to close my eyes and do some deep breathing and let them in. And sometimes they come in and sometimes they don't. Is that fair to say? What's the relationship?
Well, I'm all right, because I only want funny people, obviously. But I mean, you know, obviously if you're writing a drama and you're picking up on really bad energy, I know writers that they go in really dark places and it's something they don't talk about, but they've got a dark energy about them. And then you're like, what are you writing? Like, I've been writing a murderer. And I'm like, you've got an evil energy around you. And then I'll take it off them, basically.
How do you mean?
I'll tell it to go. Yeah, I've done that quite a few times.
Are you pulling my leg, Lucy?
No, I'm not.
So you're providing a voice for spirits to write through you, and also kind of providing a service of exorcising those, like exorcising those negative spirits through other writers.
Good. I am not at all saying I am a prolific writer. I do it on a very, very low scale, but our best writers in history, they're mediums. How do you think 1984 was written? How could he know all that?
Well, I think he made it up and was educated. And my position would be that he dreamt it up. It's a fantasy and it's a satirical fantasy based on extrapolating, like looking at what's going on around him and thinking, where could this go in a sort of nightmare scenario?
No, he was told right what to write. Stephen King completely taps into a different energy. You know, they talk to him. They tell him what to write. He doesn't even know what he's writing sometimes. You know, he sits down. It's just done for him.
I'm a big Stephen King fan, and I do know that there are books that he literally doesn't remember writing because he was razzed off his head on coke and alcohol at the time.
But that's when they can come through the most, you see, because they're in the subconscious.
Okay, then what about sci-fi writers who are writing about the future?
But again, they're still picking up on an energy of someone, you know, is guiding them. I mean, not always.
Yeah.
Not always.
That's fascinating. And I think whether or not, like, people might be listening to this thinking, she's nailed it, I've always thought that. And people might be listening thinking, come on, that's, I don't believe in any of that. But I still think it's, you know, from the perspective of a writer, the idea of, and I've certainly spoken to character comics, you'll know Colin Holt, who does Anna Mann, who, you know, really feels like he's sort of, there's a kind of spiritual element almost where he's like, I need to let Anna in. And then he said to me, there are times when I felt like I didn't let her in and I faked it and I knew and she knew. Do you know what I mean? I think there's definitely scope for us to look at what's useful about that as a technique and what's less useful about it. So does that mean that if you got a brief tomorrow, do you want to write on this sitcom in America, a new series of so-and-so, we'd like you as a staff writer, would you be kind of deliberately going towards, I've got to connect with a spirit in order to find a character?
No, but you want, I mean, I want the voices to be real. They can't be my voice. So that's got to come from somewhere. You know, sometimes I'll base it on someone, you know, and if you base it on someone, you know, then it sort of takes on a life of its own in your head. But from doing that, you know, and you think, if you think, you know, when you begin to try and visualize this, you're slowing your breathing down, you're sort of in a meditative state. That's when you get these aspirations in your head. And that's, you know, I believe that's coming from somewhere. You plug it into something, even if it is just everything you've ever known up to this point, you know. It's funny how everything starred. I star stuff, you know. But I've never read anything about writing. I've never read anything about comedy. I mean, I don't think there is enough academia. There's no academia, is there, on stand-up or comedy writing. I'm very passionate and very annoyed that it's sometimes seen as the underdog to drama. Because it's easy to make somebody cry. It's hard to make somebody laugh. And I don't think they put the money in it as much as they put in with drama. And that annoys me.
So with the tour, what kind of decisions have you made already about the stuff? Is it a case of like, I've got all this stuff and I'm going to fit it, like a theme is going to emerge? It's called The Trouble and Strife. Is that to do with it being about married life, or is it going to be to do with your kind of positioning as I'm a wife on top of being a person?
It is, yeah. It all hangs over this one incident where I made a terrible mistake, but again, it'd come from me thinking someone was being really misogynist and me totally getting the wrong end of the stick. And, you know, because a lot of people think it don't bother me at all, but think I was John's wife and I married him and then he got me on a sitcom. And they don't know. And a woman sat in Centre Parks in the swimming pool toilets. She said, "Isn't it nice that he's let you do comedy with him?" She was really lovely. I was like, "Oh, I know it is." She was like, "You're quite good at it as well." I was like, "Oh, nice." She was like, "Yeah." Like, oh, thinking, you fucking bitch. But I was trying to, you know, she didn't know. It's so fine, isn't it? She didn't know. And it wasn't like I'd had a massive career before him. So why would she not? I wasn't. But it's those two things, really. And it's very much the change, really, from the odd sort of life I have that is still like living in a sitcom, you know.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that because before I saw an episode of Meet the Richardsons, from the outside, it looked, because the part of the joke is it's presented as if it's real. So when you see the adverts, if you see a poster or a billboard for Meet the Richardsons, it looks like it's a genuine reality show. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it looks like here's two funny people. But it's not. And then I start watching it and when I started watching it, I was like, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. Why would he be ringing into the station? They must have set this up. And then I was like, oh God, I'm an idiot. It's all, do you know what I mean? It's all like a really light, I mean, and it's a tribute, I guess, to how light the touch is, that it feels real if you squint.
Yeah. I mean, we shouldn't have said, we said it was a mockumentary, so. But I think how we packaged it was wrong. I think we should have just said it was a sitcom.
Yeah.
We could really confuse people, wound people up. We sometimes get phone calls, you know, from like people saying, "What? Can you just tell me what's real, what's not?" It's like, you know, it shouldn't matter. But then it's because a lot of it is real as well, you know. It's sort of half and half. You know?
Is it difficult to navigate that in terms of how? I mean, God, there's so many questions about that because all stand-ups, obviously, we play a version of ourselves.
Yeah.
But like, you're inviting us into a version of your home and a version of your marriage, and we're familiar with your character as we see you perform. Like, it's almost like, is the you that's on Meet the Richardsons the same you that is on Cats Does Countdown?
It's a character. I think it's a performance. It's a character. Yeah, but it's the same on TV. But I think I'm probably a bit more. Yeah. It is. It's a heightened. In the same way, everyone is a bit, aren't we? I mean, God, a woman stopped me the other day now because I was chatting. She was like, "Why are you still in character now?" She thought the whole thing, the accent, being from Hull, she thought it was all a character. And she was like, "You don't need to be in character for me now." I was like, "Have you never met anyone from a regional area?" Like, never moved out of Highgate. So she didn't know that it was a real vice. But But yeah, it's all a heightened version. Yeah, and it is. I mean, we've got a script. It's scripted. So we are acting.
Because
we're acting ourselves.
It's interesting. It looked to me like I could believe that some of it was just improvised based on how well you know your character. So are the kind of the scenarios scripted and then you improvise within them, or is it all line for line scripted and then you take a run at playing the scene without the script?
So yeah, on the odd occasion, the script just says blah blah blah.
Okay.
Like but mostly it has dialogue, but we will improvise around it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll use that as a basis, but we'll say what we want. And more just to try and get that backwards and forwards banter that, you know, especially John, you know, whatever me and Tim write for John, he will always think of something funnier and sharper in the moment. And so that's mainly why we do it, you know, for John, to be honest. And I will then be able to come back with something not as sharp. but I'll throw him a curveball. We've sort of worked out what we do. I say something bizarre and he sort of tidies it up.
Right. and that feels like quite, what's lovely to watch about that is it feels like you've happened upon that in quite an organic way. Like the decisions you've made about which stuff to share, which elements of your actual relationship to heighten and to share, it feels like it's as the result of something sort of real and authentic that then you've made the right decisions about which bits of it to heighten. So it feels, you know what I mean? Like you could imagine a world in which it was heavily written and you decided on some characters and it didn't work because it wasn't based on the right elements of you. Do you know what I mean? I don't mean of you. You could imagine a different couple, a different comedy couple, not having that same kind of chemistry based on the actual sparkiness between you. As you say, you know, it feels like there's a real part of your relationship which is based on enjoying annoying each other.
Yeah. And being a bit dysfunctional, you know, it wouldn't work if we were really happy with each other. And we're trying to just be honest about what marriage is like. That, you know, how can you, if you're saying you're going to be with this person for the rest of your life, how can that be okay? You know, constantly disappointing each other and then, you know, pulling your socks up and getting on with it. That's what being married is. It's a lot of pressure to live with someone.
is there a kind of an almost therapeutic facet to it whereby because you get to complain about each other to each other and make each other laugh about it, that it helps smooth some of the edges?
Yeah, it's love, and totally. Oh, yeah, it does. Yeah, it has really helped. More that you just can't be bothered to argue when you get in if you've been filming all day. I think, and it's funny. Some people find it really uncomfortable and like a one-trick pony, and like I just don't want to keep seeing you because it is. It's the whole thing is conflict. And other people absolutely revel in it. I think it really depends where you're at in your life, you know, what your family's like. You know, if arguing in my family's love, you know, we're like Italian. It's like, you know, it's like that. Just you say what you feel, you have a massive argument and then it clears the air.
Yeah.
And then you get on with it. But John's is very different. You know, he internalises things. And so it's been good for us both, really. Yeah.
And with Meet the Richardsons, are there elements of your relationship that you've decided not to share? Are there script things or there ideas you've had for the script that you've gone, oh, this could go somewhere. And then you've gone, actually, I don't want to do that. That's too much, or it's too personal, or it might, you know, there's a risk that people who don't realise it's made up would think that was real. Is there kind of areas you've backed away from?
No, we've overshared. We've shared every single facet. I mean, we're filming our fifth series in May, June, and the fourth series is out 6th of April. you know, no, we've overshared, we've shared too much, and we've given away everything, you know, everything that's real. Most storylines come from a real story. Most of the surfer chats are things we've talked about that even that week, you know, and then we've brought it onto the surfer. You know, I've given my mum out. My mum had an affair with Johnny, you know, she was with Johnny Vegas. You know, she did say to him, you know, backstage, she did say to him off camera, I will have sex with you, Johnny, if you want me to. She didn't, you know, we've had everyone in it, all our friends, they're our real neighbours, you know, they, you know, they're really in it. So we had our daughter in, it's an actress we've got in the series that's coming out. It's not our real daughter, but, you know, we did have our real daughter in it, the first two series. So we've given too much away.
Do you have any regrets about that? Do you feel that it's made you vulnerable in any way?
Yeah. Yeah. I think we didn't necessarily need to do it for, I think, yeah, if I could do it again, I wouldn't. No, I keep real things back and just try to make things up. And so you feel like you're not really delving into your real life. Mm-hmm. Sean Locke said to John years ago, because he sort of, you know, mentored him almost, you know, and had him under his wing. He said to John, "Don't give your own life away." And John, but that's just not how John works. And I think really, Meet the Richardsons probably is more of an extension of John's stand-up, where John is so honest about, and I've not met a comic who doesn't make anything up. You know, most comics say it's all real, it's bollocks. Most people, I think everyone makes stuff up. John doesn't make anything up, and he manages to find funny things in the mundane. But I think Sean, by the sounds of it, was a bit worried about him, you know, giving everything away. Knowing the names of everyone in his family. And, you know, with Sean, he was private, really. No one knew the name of his wife and his kids and where he lived. And, you know, so I think it's just very, very different ways of approaching things, isn't it? But really.
Before we wrap up, a couple of just quick things. How do you cope when things get tough, when you're stuck with a bit of script or you have a bad gig? All those kind of things. What's your kind of reaction to that? Are you able to shake it off, or does it hit you hard?
It does, because if it didn't, it's because you care. If you didn't care, you've got to care. You've got to want to do a good job. I think I've got the experience to know why something's gone wrong, and if it has genuinely been my fault, I do have to sort of have a word with myself and go, you not feel bad and not sort of beat yourself up about it, of going, you're not perfect, you've let yourself down, but you need to make sure that when you go out tonight, you do, you know. So being easy on yourself, you're not a robot, you know. And I think being easy on yourself actually helps you do a better job. It makes you more consistent by not trying to be perfect, you know. But yeah, of course it hurts. Yeah, it feels such a privileged job to do, that if all you've got to do is make an audience laugh and you don't manage it, I would rather have a knife in my back.
what's the thing that you tried, in comedy terms, either the project that you tried or the joke that you tried, that you could just never quite get away?
A character act based on John Prescott's wife, Pauline Prescott. I had the wig. I had lovely lines. You know, it was quite Victoria Wood, you know, said I never dreamt that I'd have an extractor fan at my age. And it was like, but it just never, we did it the second series of Live at the Electric. I did it on there and it was so bad that they didn't even put it in the show. I sort of like didn't learn my lines and crumbled, and then just hadn't sort of shopped it. I hadn't gigged it enough, but you can't get, there's not many gigs you can do as a comedy. Not all gigs allow you on as a character act, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was sometimes having to like go and do a normal stand-up routine and then halfway put a wig on and try to do this character. it just never quite works. And yeah, that Pauline Prescott.
What do you think is funny about you?
The way I walk.
That's a good quick fire answer, but it's also a guarded kind of an answer. I suppose what I mean is, what do you think it is that people find funny about you? Like about your nature, about, because you're someone who I think of as, you've just got funny bones. You're just funny. And I just wonder if you could put any kind of description or kind of phrasing on that, of what you think it is that people are connecting with, that they're laughing at.
I don't know. I think it is the way I walk in my body. I'm not quite. My body's not quite right. I didn't realise, but I've got like weird leg. I think my legs are arms without fingers. And so I'm not 5'8" with long legs. And do you know what I mean? I think I'm physically. I don't sort of hold myself like, I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know.
It was a lovely answer. It was a great answer either way. Are you ambitious?
I am massively ambitious. Yeah. Yeah, I do. As I say, I feel like I've only just got started.
You've said that a few times. I love that. You've got a real kind of day one mentality.
Yeah.
Like, get the next thing, go, right, now it's day one. What's next?
Yeah, there's so much I want to. It's I want my voice. I want to feel. I want to feel like you know my words and my. I want a style. You know, I want to. Caroline O'Hearn and Victoria Woods. I'm still grieving the loss of them and what they would be doing now. I don't feel like they're talked about enough anymore. I don't feel like I'd like to sort of fund a statue for Caroline O'Hearn, where she lived. The same for Victoria Wood. I feel like they were incredible. We've lost, like, that's massive, that losing those two female comedic voices. But I'm not saying I don't think I'm as talented as them, but I want to feel like I've got a brand of humour where you could watch something and say, I know that's Lucy Beaumont's, without trying to sound, like you said, without trying to sound a bit aloof. That is what I want, you know.
What will it satisfy in you to achieve that?
I don't feel like I've had a crack of the whip properly yet. I did, you know, I enjoyed doing the, To Hull and Back was a massive learning curve, and I'm not writing on the second series of Hullraisers. I wrote on the first series, but that was a very producer-led show. Okay. I learned so much. It was amazing and worked with incredible people. But it wasn't totally all mine, you know. I want to work on things where... And now it's only from doing stuff. I want to work on things where I've created the concept and I've produced it and I've directed it and I've cast it, you know, to be able to have the responsibility of doing that, you obviously have to work for years. but that's what I want. I want complete control. And I'm not there yet because I've got to learn all these skills, you know. I haven't directed yet. That's something, you know, so I want to be able to do it. And obviously that's incredibly ambitious.
That's kind of, is that what they call being an auteur? Like when you do everything and it's entirely your vision.
Yeah, it's been a complete control freak and only believing that your decisions are the best decisions. And my decisions at the moment aren't the best decisions because I've still got a lot to learn, you know. So at least I know that. But I'll keep working until I really do believe I'm good enough to have control things, yeah.
What do you think has most held you back? In terms of your nature,
in comedy,
yeah,
predatory male behaviour is what has. I've had quite a few incidences where, if you were in any other workforce, you would go to HR, or you would, and there isn't one. And I think it's just everywhere, and it's not sort of talked about enough. And it upsets me when I hear about young female comics having the same experiences. And it seems, I thought it was for a while, it was the same like 5 or 6 people. And now it's not. Now I could name you sort of 10, 15, because of course people talk. I mean, you know, like comedy's got the biggest gossips ever. So everybody knows. Or if you don't know yet, the ones I know, you will do soon.
Yeah.
But it attracts such interesting, passionate, raw, edgy, wounded people. But we don't sort of talk about the fact it also attracts predatory men that are really messed up and sexually have been repressed for years and get a bit of fame and, you know, display these behaviours, and it just gets covered up. Their agents know and the channels know, and no one seems to be doing anything about it. But yeah, it massively has, you know, as much, you know, obviously I've talked about the sexism as well, but obviously someone invading your private space it stays with you. And it's just like, I've stopped myself. I was going to say men don't have to deal with it, but they do. Men do, because if you're not that type of man, you really hate that other men do that type of thing as well. We all have to deal with it. But yeah, there's been times I've wanted to go on Twitter and just let people know everyone that we talk about that we're not allowed to say. I've just gone, this guy, they are, your young girls are not safe around these men, and they're patrons of charities and they're paid the biggest sums of money, and you can't trust them, you know. It needs ridding of it. How long are we all going to just in private say, God, did you hear about so-and-so? And, oh, that he's done that again. You know, we know who they are. There's no room for them. They're not that good anyway. Do you know what I mean? It's not like...
People go on Twitter and sort of... people suggest people without, you know, people in our industry suggest names without naming names. And then all the comments underneath will be like, well, you know, name and shame, name them then. And you're like, you're sort of legally prevented. You're legally responsible and you can be done for slander if something's not proved or whatever. So there doesn't seem to be any recourse other than sort of so-called whisper networks whereby people can get, I mean, I, with other male comics, friends of mine, I've not done it for a while, but I'd meet and go, hey, so who's on your list? Who else do I need to worry about? To try and foster amongst male comics the same thing that is naturally endemic amongst female comics, where you have to meet and say, you know, who have we got to be? Have you heard the latest person, the latest addition to the list, the latest person we've got to worry about?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's one of them things, but, you know, it's just an, you know, when you ask me that question, what's prevented you? It's like, who else, you know, I don't want this to be a problem for anyone else. I want it stopping, you know, but like you say, it's not that easy, but it's just important, even like this, just to be frank, you know. I was going to make up something in my head and I thought, I'll just be honest with you, because it has really set me back, you know.
Thank you for that, Lucy. Let's end on an upbeat note that kind of honours how positive this situation is, how positive your personal situation is now, and that honours the fact that you have not been beaten by these kind of experiences, and that you have thrived regardless. What is the contribution to comedy of which you're most proud? Whether that's a joke, an idea, a look, a moment. What's the thing that you hold in your heart most?
Oh, in terms of like a moment.
In terms of anything, just something in comedy that you think, well, I've always got that.
Oh, I think it's to Hull and Back. It's the series I wrote on Radio 4, and you know, I'm so proud of it. And there's just this one line where they're in a French restaurant, and she's Jean, the character, is. She's out of her depth and she doesn't know what to order. And she orders a main course and the waitress says, entrees. And she says, oh no, just some plates, they'll be fine. So yeah, it, very easterly and old fashioned. That's just how I like my comedy.
Love it.
And my men.
That's a double punchline to finish off. Yeah. How structurally satisfying. Thank you so much, Lucy. Have a fantastic time on the tour, and I look forward to the new series of Meet the Richardsons.
Thank you ever so much.
So that was Lucy. Bit more stuff with her, maybe 15 minutes or so, are on the Insiders feed at comedianscomedian.com/insiders if you would like to join that with a small donation. But remember, don't miss Lucy's tour at the end of this year, 2023. It's called The Trouble and Strife, and you can find out all of your details from lucybeaumont.co.uk, as well as all of her social handles. You can find out everything you need to about the podcast at comedianscomedian.com or my own projects at stuartgoldsmith.com, including my new work in the fields of resilience and personal sustainability. That's right, I'm doing a comedian saying the unsayable about the climate crisis and helping your directors of sustainability to recharge their climate messaging. So if you're the sort of person or organisation that has or knows a director of sustainability, give me a shout via the contact forms at stuartgoldsmith.com. Exciting stuff there. And of course, come and see me in Edinburgh. Can't believe I didn't hammer that earlier on. From stuartgoldsmith.com, you can find your links to come and see me at 3:20 p.m. in Monkey Barrel 1 every day throughout August, apart from the 16th. It's going to be fantastic by then. Of that, you have my word. Goodbye for now. Thank you very much to the team, which currently stands as Nathan Wood, Susie Lewis, Charlotte Wakely, and occasionally, and whenever he wants back in, Moz. So thank you to all of those. The music was by Rob Smouten, and Peter Dobbing continues to be your podcast consultant, and it all happens for the benefit of Brett Goldstein. So thank you, everybody. Follow the socials at Stuart Goldsmith Comedy. I've had a lovely gag there. Start to just maybe go off again, which is about Spotify. And the most fun thing about making jokes from the perspective of a 45-year-old man on social media is that lots of young people get really angry, and okay, boomer me, but I'm not technically a boomer. Ha! Stick around for a post-amble in just a moment. Other than that, bye bye. There we go. We went with bye bye there. Maybe that could be my unique sign off. Bye bye. The thing I didn't talk to you about last time, which is remiss of me, was Tough Mudder. Now listen, this isn't going to be me wanging on trying to convince you all to start doing exercise. I don't care about you. I mean, I do care about you, but I care about you enough to know that wanging on about telling you to do exercise is not going to work. This is a parallel journey to me learning about not wanging on telling people to do better with the climate. Don't worry. I'm going to try not to be smug. I'm going to try not to get under people's skin by just kind of... It's so easy to be too much. God, I had a chat with my mum and my brother recently, and I was telling them both about my ADHD diagnosis, and they had some questions, and I was sort of proving it to my brother by going, well, you know how I'm a bit much? And he was like, yeah. I was like, well, there we go. I don't know if that counts. That's not proof. That's just social proof elements. But anyway, the point is, I just wanted to thank everyone on my amazing Tough Mudder team. Tough Mudder, for those of you that don't know, is a... well, it bills itself as a sort of terrifying quasi-military force march through mud and horrendous kind of obstacles. But really what it is, it's a bit like... It's a bit like Torture Garden, if you've ever been there. It's sort of the entry-level mass appeal version of the thing that it purports to be. See also Lynx Africa and the magazine Just 17. But so what it is, really, is a fun obstacle course. You do get very muddy, and if you don't fancy any of the obstacles, you could walk round them. But we did them all, and it was so fun. We did the 5K one. It took about 2 hours, because most of it, you're not running 5K. You're running 500 metres and then stopping and scratching your head and looking at a weird tower thing and going, how the hell are we going to get up there? It's so fun, and it's particularly because of the people you're with. And I was with Anya Magliano, I was with Stuart Laws, with Shaparak Korsandi, Jessica Fostercue, Esther Minito, and I can't have forgotten anyone. That's everyone, right? Oh, God, I'm going to have to check the WhatsApp group now. I'm sure that's everyone, but I'm so mortally afraid of forgetting anyone. Come on, here we go. And Ivo, of course. I mean, bloody ran the whole way with Ivo Graham as he kept getting stopped and recognised from Taskmaster. Great joy. So that was the team, and it was just a really, really fun bunch of people. you like, I just recommend doing this to anyone. Do it for charity, in strict defiance of my stand-up material from 8 years ago. But it was a really, really fun thing, and I would really recommend it. I had been put off by the kind of branding of it, but like so many things that appear to be exclusive and beyond you, see also surfing and golf. Once you do them, you go, oh, it's just this. You learn the rules, you accept you're crap at it because you're new, and you just do the thing, and then it turns out to basically be, the reason I've chosen surfing and golf is because both of those sports are a nice chat. Kind of with, you know, if you do them with someone, they're basically a nice chat with occasional moments of excitement or sort of drowning. But the key thing about them, the reason why they're fun to do, is because you just get to bob around having a bit of a natter. And that's kind of my best bit about this. I have to say, as well, I'm not going to be disingenuous about this. I was pretty good at it. And it's almost the only, other than the 10K last year. Look, if you're not an exercise person, if you're offended by it, you'll have switched off by now. So I'm just going to be upfront about this. The 10K last year and then the Tough Mudder were the only opportunities I've had to sort of test the fact that I'm quite fit now compared to how I was against a thing. So I've been quietly, I always remember that there's a thing Henry Rollins said when he got into weightlifting when he was at school or he was at college or something, and his powerlifting, I'm not using the wrong terms, the guy who was teaching him how to do it said, you're not allowed to look at yourself in the mirror for 3 months. And so he just kind of didn't look at himself in the mirror. And then, of course, 3 months is long enough that your body's physically changed shape and then you have this enormous boost. I feel like I've had an equivalent experience because I'm not going racing. I'm not a will-to-win person. I never time myself. I don't even use the bloody, what was it, my run or Strava or whatever. I don't use it anymore. I often don't take my watch with me. I just run my little loop and I'm like, there we go, I've run. And as a result, I hadn't tested it against anything. So enormous excitement when the 10K thing was good. And when that was fun. But this, there were three or four things that I looked at it and I thought, like, you know, a really tall wall that you've got to throw yourself out and just get up it on your own. And I managed to do it on my own without any help. And the first time I did one of them, I just kind of, it was just one of those, what's your man's name? Scott Pilgrim, when he pulls forth from himself the sword of whatever it is. I was like, oh my God, I can actually do this. And then I was like, yeah, Ready Brett guy running around the place. That's a 45-year-old reference, if ever you've heard one. So I really recommend them. And I'm so grateful. I would never have said yes to doing the thing were I not so excited to have been asked. I've been selected for a team of cool friends. I literally rolled on the ground like a puppy. So I'm very, very grateful to the team for their support. And also, it's just such a really nice vibe. And if I'm allowed, and if enough of you ask for it, and maybe I'll do it as a reward for something. I can't believe I haven't already done this. I could post the very short video of me apparently misguidedly treating the last part of the Tough Mudder, which was a sort of electrifying you through little wires thing, treating it apparently incorrectly as a sort of Catherine Zeta-Jones in Entrapment style laser maze. I legged it through it like a little balletic crab and didn't get zapped. And then everyone else charged straight into it and got zapped loads. I think Manita actually almost got, I mean, she slammed forwards into a puddle, you know, for which I have nothing but respect and admiration. Apologies there for the rival tone in my voice. But I just thought it was funny that I regret it because everyone else got zapped and I'd quite like to have been zapped. But I just thought, well, I mean, there's no rules here that say you have to not try to get zapped. And I was just pretty limber, guys, and I zeted my way through it and very happy about it too. So anyway, that's a little blurb about that. I highly recommend it. Thanks once again to Lucy. Bye for now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both as twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.